puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
It's our Sunday morning check-in with Gordon Goldsborough and time for Abandoned Manitoba. Hi, Gordon.
Hi, Nadia.
What are we talking about this week?
We're talking about an old building in Winnipeg that now sits vacant, and it looks kind of like a fortress. It's surrounded by a tall concrete wall, and in fact, the wall is topped with barbed wire. You know, one might think it used to be a prison, but it had a much more benevolent purpose that relates to the topic of my next book.
Ooh, what's your next book about?
Well, I'm fascinated by the history of public infrastructure. How did the systems we enjoy today come to be? You know, for example, we take for granted that when you flip a light switch in your home, the lights come on, and we're mostly unaware of the infrastructure that makes this possible. That's what I'd like to show people in my next book, the history of our electrical supply, our communications network, our highways, our government facilities. Well, a whole lot more. There's lots of systems we just depend on every single day. And I'll be talking about some of these projects here on Abandoned Manitoba as we go forward over the next few months, such as today's look at the Rover Electric Terminal. It was once the backbone of Winnipeg's cheap power supply.
Cheap power supply?
Well, you know, it's often pointed out that Manitobans enjoy low prices for electricity by a virtue of our abundant water resources. You know, we have lots of rivers and lakes. A recent study by Hydro-Québec shows that of 22 major cities around North America, Winnipeg is second only to Montreal in the lowest rates on the continent. By comparison, New York City pays over triple what we do here. You know, we're really quite fortunate. And we can thank the visionaries of Winnipeg city councillors in the early 20th century for that fact, because they switched our reliance on coal and other non-renewable resources to water power over 100 years ago. They built a system to deliver electricity to every home and business in the city. And two key components of that system were the Pointe du Bois Generating Station on the Winnipeg River and the Rover Electric Terminal here in Winnipeg. Pointe du Bois is still very much in operation. In fact, it's the oldest of Manitoba Hydro's generating stations, but Rover is now abandoned.
So why is it called the Rover Electric Terminal?
Well, to get the hydropower from Pointe du Bois to Winnipeg, there was a 77-mile transmission line to convey what at the time was 60,000 volts of power. That line arrived in the city at the Rover Electric Terminal, and it was called Rover. I always think of a dog, because the terminal was situated on Rover Avenue. That's in Point Douglas. And it was called a terminal, as in where something stops, you know, the terminus of that transmission line. In truth, the power did not stop at Rover, though, but it was where electricity was redistributed to substations around Winnipeg. So, for example, there's a 60,000-volt line that connects Rover with substation number 5 on Scotland Avenue, from which homes and businesses around Fort Rouge were supplied with, well, either 110 or 220 volts of power. The Scotland substation was also significant because it was the starting place for a transmission line that went to Portage-la-Prairie. And that was the first step in the widespread electrification of the entire province. Of course, we now know that, you know, lines crisscross all over the province. Well, the very first one went from the Scotland substation out to Portage. 12,000-volt lines from Rover also supplied substations on King Street, which, by the way, I had an opportunity to visit 2 weeks ago, and it's now abandoned, as well as on St. Matthews Avenue. There was a substation there, on Portage Avenue, and on McPhillip Street. And from these substations, electricity radiated in all directions to supply the entire city.
And when was the Rover Electric Terminal constructed?
Well, work started in early 1910, about a year after construction of Pointe du Bois began. A two-story brick and stone structure with a full basement was built, and electrical equipment was installed inside that Rover terminal. In October of 1911, the terminal began operational testing just as the first generator at Pointe du Bois was put into service. At the same time, Substation 1 on King Street, Substation 2 on McPhillips, and Substation 3 on Waterfront Drive began operated, so that on the 16th of October, 1911, a few minutes after 5 p.m., the four-year-old son of Mayor Sanford Evans flipped the switch at Substation 3, and that turned on the streetlights on Sherbrooke and Maryland Street. Suddenly, there was light where there had previously been darkness. That little boy's father and city councillors flipped other switches to turn on the lights elsewhere in the city. Meanwhile, the pumps that were used to draw water from wells at three sites around the city began using hydropower to pump the water. And the first commercial building to be lit by water was the steel block located at 360 Portage Avenue.
That must have been a pretty big deal.
Well, yeah, it was. You know, with the flip of a few switches, the price of electricity in Winnipeg plummeted. And there were two interesting tidbits of historical symbolism with that ceremony on October the 16th. First, that young fellow who flipped the first switch, his name was Gurney Evans, and some of our listeners may remember him. He went on to a long and distinguished career in provincial politics, serving in the Legislative Assembly for 15 years, from 1954 to 1969, and he held several ministerial portfolios. The other interesting fact is that that first building to be powered by Pointe-du-Bois, the steel block, was later torn down, and the site is now occupied by the corporate headquarters for Manitoba Hydro. So, nice sort of connection there. The first building now is the headquarters for power.
Now, earlier you referred to the Rover Electric Terminal looking like a prison. Why is it surrounded by a tall concrete wall and barbed wire?
Well, you might well ask, of course. Well, unlike a prison, which uses fences and barbed wire to keep the inmates in, the wall and wire at Rover were intended to keep things out. The wire is, I suspect, there to prevent people who try to scale the wall from being hurt by the high voltages that exist inside. You know, you could get seriously hurt or worse by climbing the wall. So I think that's just meant to dissuade people more than anything else. But the wall itself was built in the aftermath of the catastrophic flood that hit Winnipeg in 1950. You know, that's probably the worst flood in living memory here in Winnipeg. And during that flood, they had to build a temporary sandbag dike around the Rover terminal because, well, frankly, if you imagine if that terminal was to be swamped and if it succumbed to those floodwaters, well, the entire city would be plunged into darkness because that's where the power originated for everything. And of course, there'd be no power for things like pumps. If you're pumping the water out to try to keep ahead of the flood, well, it's too bad. The pumps are now turned off. So they needed to make sure that there was no future chance of that vital station being damaged by floodwater. So they built this concrete wall around it. And if you look at it, it's really thick. And I guess that's because they needed to hold back an awful lot of water. Water is pretty heavy. And you know, that's really there to prevent a future flood. Now, the inside, if you ever get a chance to go inside that compound then around the Rover terminal, there's actually a neat little plaque on the wall mounted on the inside of that retaining wall. And it's about 3 feet off the ground. That's the point where the floodwater peaked during the 1950 flood. And I was standing beside it thinking, wow, you know, what it must have been like to be standing there, you know, that many years ago. Yet I don't know if that wall was ever truly needed because, well, of course, I think as everyone knows, the Red River Floodway was completed in 1968. And it essentially eliminated the prospect of flooding at the Rover Terminal.
Why was Rover abandoned?
Well, as you might imagine, the technology for doing the work that Rover did for, well, over a century has advanced to the point where the equipment, the circuitry inside Rover is simply not needed anymore. The entire function has been fully automated using something called DCSs, or distributed control systems. DCSs occupy a fraction of the space needed for Rover's equipment, and perhaps just as importantly, they don't need to be kept warm in the winter. So they can sit outside. In other words, you don't need a building to put them in. And so if you stand at entrances through that wall at Rover, you're going to see a small cluster of these DCSs sitting on concrete pads in the yard. And they do all the work that used to be done inside the building beside them. And they don't need any people to operate them. So therefore, you don't need any staff at the site either.
So what's going to happen to the old electric terminal?
Well, I was inside it a few weeks ago, and it's been slowly decommissioned by the staff of Manitoba Hydro. The most hazardous equipment has been removed, but there's still quite a lot inside there. And before they can do any kind of demolition, it all has to be removed. So it's going to take time. But my sources tell me that when the building is completely empty, it will be demolished. Although I wonder if the concrete wall will be retained to protect those DCSs from, well, maybe some future hazard. May not be flooding. Maybe there's some other catastrophe. If so, that wall will be an ongoing reminder of the key role that the Rover Electric Terminal used to play in making electricity the ubiquitous and cheap resource on which we all depend today.
Thanks for this, Gordon. It's hard to imagine a time before, hey?
Absolutely.
So I appreciate this. What's up for next week?
Well, now that summer is nearly here, and of course it's not so easy to tell with the last few days, but the thoughts of many of our listeners will be on life at the cottage. So I thought it would be interesting to talk next week about some of the historic summer cottages that exist at sites around Lake Winnipeg.
Look forward to that. Thank you, Gordon.
We'll see you then. Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba, many moons.